Hello everyone and welcome to Ledbury Poetry Festival's evening, lovely warm evening that we're having. And a big thank you to Arts Council England because this wouldn't be happening without them. So I have great pleasure in introducing Maitreya Bandhu
again.
which is double the pleasure. His first pamphlet, The Bond, won the Poetry Book and Pamphlet Competition and was shortlisted for the Michael Marx Award. Vita Brevis, his second pamphlet, won the IOTA Shots Award, try saying that 10 times fast, and is a Poetry Book Society pamphlet choice. His first full-length collection, The Crumb Road from Blood Axe, is a Poetry Book Society recommendation. And Yarn, his second full collection with Blood Axe, was published last autumn. He's a member of the Triratna.
Well done.
Buddhist Order for 26 years and is the author of 3 books on Buddhism, including the best-selling Life and Full Attention, a practical course in mindfulness. And he lives and works in the London Buddhist Centre. And he's going to be introducing us to a special Irish poet, Maeve McGuckin, in a minute. So big welcome to Maitreya Bandhu.
So welcome everyone, really good to see you all this evening. Particularly welcome to Maeve, but I'll welcome her properly in a moment. So this is Poetry East on Tour. In fact, this is the end of our Poetry East on Tour. We're going to pack up the Buddha and take him home. I founded Poetry East at the London Buddhist Centre about 6 years ago, and my intention was to show how meditation, Buddhism, goes together with poetry, how in a way they're the same thing. So I was thinking just earlier of Dr. Johnson's famous dictum about a sudden elevations of the mind. Do you know that one? He said that that's what you're always looking for in reading poems. That sudden elevation of the mind. I was very struck by that when I read it, that sudden elevation of the mind. And you know what it's like, that sometimes you do, don't you? That you suddenly take off reading poems. I remember once I memorised Keats' Hyperion, and I remember being on the train and saying it out loud, and just having that sudden elevation of the mind. Interestingly, what happened to me then is I burst into tears. Sometimes when your mind is elevated, you feel this kind of grief that you're not living in that state. It's as if it's not like you go into some other consciousness. It feels like the consciousness that you're lifted into is your real consciousness, and that the rest of the time you've just got, I don't know, foolishly preoccupied with emails and arguments and politics and all that sort of thing, that for those moments you'd been residing in who you really are. And for me, sometimes that can be accompanied by real tears. Not so long ago, I went to see the Meister Singers, and that famous quintet. I just had this same experience of being completely taken out of myself, and yet more deeply into myself for that, if you see what I mean. So that is for that reason that Sangharakshita, the founder of the Buddhist order I've dedicated my life to, it's for that reason that he says that if you were to look for a precedent to Buddhism in the West, you'd find it in the arts, not so much in religion. It feels much more like what I'm trying to do when I'm meditating, what I'm trying to do in my friendships, in my ethical life, feels much more like trying to live my life so that I can have those sudden elevations of mind. Yeah. So what I'd like to do just to settle us for this evening is just a very short meditation just to settle down. Then I'm going to introduce, we'll do all sorts of other things like that. But it starts with an interview, a conversation with Maeve and I, and then there'll be a tea break, and then there'll be Maeve will read her poems. But let's, for the moment, just close our eyes. And with your eyes closed, just see if you can feel once again the weight of your body on the chair. Coming home to yourself in this simple sense. So So coming back to what John Burnside would call your creaturely sense. See if you can feel the whole weight of your body sitting here, your feet on the floor. And then just for a few moments, just tuning into your breath. Feeling your breath coming in and going out. Noticing your weight. Feeling the support of the chair. And feeling your breath. So see if you can follow the whole breath in and the whole breath out. And as you breathe out, you can imagine your whole body just settling down a bit more, soothing the body, soothing your mind. We don't need to think about stuff anymore, we can just settle down. And then coming back to your weight on the chair, feeling that weight. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes. So we always ask Poetry's our guest poet to suggest two poems that have influenced them. So first of all, Bethany is going to read a poem by Tess Gallagher. Yeah.
Instructions to the Double. So now it's your turn, little mother of silences, little father of half-belief. Take up this face, these daily rounds, with a cabbage under each arm, convincing the multitudes that a well-made anything could save them. Take up, most of all, these hands, trained to an ornate piano in a house on the other side of the country. I'm staying here, without music, without applause. I'm not going to wait up for you. Take your time. Take mine, too. get into some trouble I'll have to account for. Walk into some bars alone with a slit in your skirt. Let the men follow you on the street with their clumsy propositions, their loud hatred of this and that. Keep walking. Keep your head up. They are calling to you, slut, mother, virgin, whore, daughter, adulteress, lover, mistress, bitch, wife, cunt, harlot, betrothed, Jezebel, Messalina, Diana, Bathsheba, Rebecca, Lucretia, Mary, Magdalena, Ruth, you, Niobe, woman of the tombs. Don't stop for anything, not a caress or a promise. Go to the temple of poets. Not the one like a rundown country club, but the one on fire, with so much it wants to be done with. Say all the last words and the first. Hello, goodbye, yes, I, please, always, never. If anyone from the country club asks if you write poems, say, your name is Lizzie Borden. Show him your axe, the one they gave you with a silver blade, your name engraved there like a whisper of their own. If anyone calls you a witch, burn for him. If anyone calls you less or more than you are, let him burn for you. It's a dangerous mission. You could die out there. You could live forever.
Thank you. Thank you. That's great. Thank you. Well done. And then Singing Mouse is going to read a poem by Seamus Heaney.
Midterm break. I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells, knelling classes to a close. At 2 o'clock, our neighbours drove me home. In the porch, I met my father crying. He'd always taken funerals in his stride, and Big Jim Evans saying it was a hard blow. The baby cooed and laughed and rocked the pram when I came in, and I was embarrassed by old men standing up to shake my hand and tell me they were sorry for my trouble. Whispers informed strangers I was the eldest, away at school, as my mother held my hand in hers and coughed out angry, tearless sighs. At 10 o'clock, the ambulance arrived with the corpse, staunched and bandaged by the nurses. Next morning, I went up into the room. Snowdrops and candles soothed the bedside. I saw him for the first time in 6 weeks, paler now, wearing a poppy bruise on his left temple. He lay in the 4-foot box as in his cot. No gaudy scars. The bumper knocked him clear. A 4-foot box. A foot for every year.
Thank you, Singerman. Thank you. So I'm really delighted to welcome Maeve McGuthian. Can you come up, Maeve? It's lovely to sometimes, when I was talking to Chloe, the director of the festival, she was saying, yes, but who would you, if we brought you to the festival, who would you like to interview? And I said, well, I'd like to interview Maeve McGuthian. So I'm really, really delighted to be interviewing you tonight, Maeve. I mean, one of those, you know, sometimes you see a poet, you think, actually, I need to read that poet deeply. I can't just, you know, I can't just read them casually. I need to give them real time. So rare that people do that now, I think. You know, it's so easy just to sort of anthologize and so on, and that's fine to start with. But it gave me the excuse to read Maeve properly, and I must say I'm just delighted to have that opportunity, so I'm very, very pleased to welcome Maeve McGuffin. So Maeve, perhaps you tell us about the choice versus Tess Gallagher. I don't know Tess's poems.
Well, it's a bit the wrong way round, because the Heaney poem is the first, and then Tess is the second.
Let's start with the Heaney.
It's kind of chronological. I was writing poetry, or I was trying to write poetry in school. There were no poetry readings in the town, in the city. I went to one in a boys' school one night, and I was the only woman in the room, and there was all these men and priests and things, you know. But I was determined to break through into this society. So 1966, I can just remember my father came in, and he was all excited because he had read in the paper and he showed me this paragraph about this book, Death of a Naturalist, and he said, "There's a boyo," as my dad would say, "there's a boyo has bypassed the whole lot of them." Meaning that he had come out of the sticks, he had come out of the underworld of Derry, and he'd got over to London and he'd got fame and he was published, and he didn't depend on the local talent or local... I mean, he never would have got... What he was saying was he never would have got through the sectarian sort of world that we lived in. So I went down to the library, and I've spent my life going down to the library, and I got the book out. I think I ordered the book, but I couldn't afford the book. So I was saying to you that I would model myself on a poet, and I copied out in longhand the whole book.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it was just so important. And the poem itself may not be the best one in the book, but it's the most memorable. It was the kind of poetry that I wanted to write myself, and was like very true to a childhood experience, or it was on the edge of puberty, sort of poem. Incredibly difficult. I mean, the way he doesn't even tell you what really happened until the very end. And it's all like repressed, and the mother being repressed. And a lot of his poems are about his mother and himself and these very sort of almost touching the mother but not touching, you know. And Big Jim Evans would be a Protestant neighbour, and Seamus would do that quite a lot, kind of include people from both sides. He's always done that. So I just thought it was that kind of style I wanted, you know, the kind of balance between the baby laughing and cooing and everyone else crying. So much in it. It's like you were saying, I think it was you saying about poetry being images, and very filmic. And it's like you could make a whole film out of that scene, scene, the little boy and the car. I wrote an essay about Seamus Heaney and the car. Because cars feature so much in his work.
Indeed,
and they're very ambiguous creatures. They source of freedom, but danger, and the vehicle of death, the vehicle of love in his work. So, yeah, I just think he's been very economical, and I wanted to write like that. So that was 19.
You met him as well, didn't you?
Oh,
well,
yes.
Come on to that, perhaps.
We met him, of course. Well, I never thought we would at that stage, you know. But then when I was 18 and I graduated into Queen's University, and he was there, he was teaching. The first year we were there, he was very forbidding, very remote figure, lecturing us, and there was maybe 300 in the room, and I was terrified of him because his brilliance was evident. I didn't think I'd ever be able to talk to him. You know, I mean, how had I ever talked to this person? So he went off to America, and we thought that was the end of him, and then he came. Well, no, I don't mean... We had mourned his passing, let's say. Well, we won't ever. But he came back again, and he seemed to be more liberated when he came back. And also we were then in seminar with him, with like maybe 10 of us in a small group. And he was absolutely wonderful. You know, he would come in and he had these huge, he had no dress sense. But that was, nobody from Balahi has any dress sense. But he achieved a dress sense later. But he had these huge orange boots, you see, and they were bright, bright orange. And he would say, and I just remember sitting, staring at these boots, you know, and the light that was coming off these boots. And where did you get? And they weren't even Dr. Martens. I don't know what they were. But then he would come in, and sometimes, and he'd say, "I'm not great today. I'm not great," because he'd maybe been out drinking or something. He says, "I tell you what, we'll go back to my house and see what I'm like there." And we all just, we'll go back to his house, and he would take the, and then he wouldn't take the seminar. He would just chat to us, and it was much more interesting than seminars. But anyway, he was really come out of himself, and all the rest of it. So, not to, you know, and he never forgot any of us. He never forgot any of us, and we never forgot him. So he left then to go to Dublin, and again disappeared, as we thought, forever. But then he came back and was all over the place as well.
You got to know him then?
Yeah, I got to know him more so after, when I started publishing. I think I kind of annoyed him, because I was writing these poems and they weren't very good. They weren't very good at all. But he had to sort of say they were good, you know, because he didn't want me to be in absolute tears. So then when I started writing sort of good or successful poems, then he felt he could manage me a bit more better. I don't think he ever managed to manage me totally. But anyway, Achnoy was just, he was... Yeah, we very much missed him. Terrific, terrific person. So I shouldn't moan on about him. This one, again, is even more sort of controversial. I was very ignorant. I was very... thought only men wrote poetry. I mean, I knew there were a few women and a few women around the place, and but there weren't any where I was. There weren't any, and nobody was interested in doing it. You know, I could never even meet. I could meet a lot of men, young fellas, who all wanted to write poetry, but there weren't. There was a couple of women who had got a bit sour and had written a bit, and then they'd fallen out with whoever they were with and dropped the whole thing. And that was what I was doing. You know. Like, in order to write your poetry, you nearly have to be in a relationship with a poet, a male poet who would look in your work and pull you out of your shell and help you along and get you published. So I had one of these, and, yeah, took a lot of took a lot of work. But anyway, this guy who was supposed to be helping me fell in love with this lady here, who came over. She was on a Guggenheim Award. Mm. And so my first introduction to her was that he said he'd met this amazing woman whom he was going to... And she was so amazing, and writing her poetry, and that, you know, I was completely irrelevant. Because I was not a good poet, and I was not American. I hadn't won a Guggenheim. I still haven't won a Guggenheim, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, so my introduction to her was really quite sort of difficult, because, you know, she's taken this guy off me. That's it, I mean, you know. But she turned out to be very, very... wonderful. She turned out to be, I believe, I could see what was, she was incredibly wonderful. Mm. And her poems to me, as Bethany's reading was absolutely incredible there. You know, and that's only one of like thousands of poems that she's written, and they are wonderful. Mm. So the thing that helped me then, that was 1976, it was 10 years after Seamus's book, you know, and the address and the energy and that poem has the kind of like arrogance and the kind of female passion in it. Mm. And I mean, I did sit with her and talk about poetry, and she would talk about Anna Akhmatova, and she'd say, "Anna Akhmatova," and I'd go, "Who? Who's this person?" And she'd go, "Oh dear, you know, like I was a sorry case." I was a sorry case, you know. As Matthew Sweeney had nothing on me, you know. And then she'd say, "Well, you know, you might prefer Svitaeva," and I'm going, "What? What's that language you're talking?" And she'd pity me, and you know, but she was incredibly generous. Because and then even Rilke. She has quotations from Rilke, and when I read this book, and I'm going, "Who is this? Who is this? What is this?" And so it was a complete revelation to me in my benighted state in 1976. Mm. So I'm very grateful to her, especially for taking the young man off. It was absolutely no use anyway. No, we're still good friends. We're all good friends. Okay, so that's that. That's why I really...
I wanted to go back to you a bit, introduce you a bit more. I thought it'd be interesting to find out a bit about your childhood, the life you come in. You've described yourself as being as growing up in a close knit working class ghetto, Catholic ghetto in Belfast.
Did I say Westfast?
Yes, you said Belfast.
Not West Belfast. No. Oh dear. West Belfast, no, is definitely the working class. Matthew said his father was a primary school headmaster, and equally my father was a primary school headmaster. That was as far as, unless you were Seamus Heaney, for example, that was as far as a Catholic male of any intelligence or even of supreme intelligence. My father was an incredibly bright guy. Mm. But that was as far as they could progress. And he actually was from a peasant farm. I don't know if they were on the edge of poverty or they had a few fields, but there were 12 children. So he went to Strawberry Hill to get his diploma in teaching because Catholics weren't allowed to go to the local... institutions. Mm. So they all came over here, and primary school headmaster was not particularly congenial to his nature, I don't think. I mean, he was very overworked and very pressured by the 11 plus thing and getting everybody through. And he did get everybody through. He got all these young men, boys through, but at a terrible price emotionally, I think. So he was always out and he was always on call, you know. And my mother was, I think, even much brighter in some ways, but she was quite literary, and he was literary. So there were good influences in that way, but they had no freedom. I mean, to write poetry, to live writing poetry would never have been an option for them. And, yeah, so what did you say I was...
Well, you talked about a working class ghetto.
It wasn't really. It turned into a working class ghetto when we all moved out, because we were the kind of middle class. We were climbing up to be middle class Catholics out of a peasant. My mother's family would have been very working class, but they weren't even working class because the Catholics couldn't get jobs, so they all were kind of. Hit and miss, and you know, they waited for the boats coming in, and then they didn't get permanent jobs in the shipyards. They just worked whenever there was a need for surplus workers. So, but we were very happy in that world, but it was very circumscribed by the church. There was like the church, and there was the school, and there was the police station somewhere. You know, it was like just... And you'd, you know, you walked round and round these buildings. And the church was paramount of, you know... Especially my mother was... what do you call? She was a third order Carmelite. And, you know, she was very, very religious and very into all the... rituals and things, but I don't know if she was happy with. I mean, it was. I mean, there were some things that she questioned. You know, I remember her saying once she was refused communion from a priest because she had lipstick on. And I said, "What's he doing looking at you and your lipstick? What are you supposed to be giving out Holy Communion?" You know. But she accepted that she was in the wrong. So, yeah.
And when did writing poetry enter your life?
I don't know, very early. I mean, I remember people saying... My father once he thought I was a prodigy, you know, because he said, she can read the newspaper, she's only three. But my sister has a niece, and she's only two. She can read the newspaper.
Another prodigy.
Yeah, not a prodigy. But anyway, I always loved reading and words, and I started then writing. My sister would come home from school, and she would have to write a poem like Hiawatha. They were doing Hiawatha, and she'd come home and say, "We have to write 10 lines, Hiawatha type." poems, and I would write the Hiawatha type, you know, that whatever it was. I was good at that rhythm, and then she would bear her poem into the school, and she would get praise and approval. And so I liked doing that. And then when I went to my convent grammar school first year, they had a school magazine. And they were requiring poems for the school magazine. So I was writing poems for the school magazine. Every day, every night, I'd write. When I finished my homework, I'd write. I had to finish my homework first. Then I did the poems. But when they eventually published the magazine, they published just a four-line verse of mine, one tiny verse, even though I'd handed in so many poems. And I thought they were so much better, and... she'd only put these four lines. It was a horrible poem. Well, not as horrible. A silly poem about ducks, you know, based on William Allingham's Little Ducks and the Ducks in the Pond. So I knew that poetry was always going to be a difficult vocation. And I knew, I was never going to make it, really.
Of course, I'm going to have to ask you that question about... your relationships to the Troubles in Northern Ireland. You know, Mahon famously talks about, perhaps I should have lived it bomb by bomb.
Yeah.
You've got this wonderful poem, Drawing Ballerinas, which confronts the troubles from your own perspective. Both you and Heaney have been criticised sometimes for not talking about them enough or not talking about them in the right way.
Yeah,
what was your experience of that from your own perspective?
You see, my mother brought us up to be, as I say, completely ignorant, really, of many things, especially Akhmatova and all that sort of stuff, but also of our identity. I mean, we were first and foremost Catholics. Mm. We were not Irish. Mm. We never felt that we were Irish. Nobody ever sort of said, well, you know, actually, you should be talking Irish or whatever. You're English, and the whole thing was to be British and watch British TV, and Irish was out of the window. So when it all started in 1968 or so, 69, it was like a bombshell to me. I had no idea what this was about at all, none whatsoever. I mean, I knew that there were two different worlds, and I knew that the street behind us was very dangerous because we weren't allowed to go down that street ever. Mm. But I didn't question that. It was just like, you don't go down that street. And then they started throwing stones and bricks into our house, and the houses along our street were... the street was Catholic-Protestant mixed, but they would have identified the Catholic houses and thrown the bricks in. Mm. So it was all complete shock to my system as well, you know, at that time. I still don't quite understand it, you know.
Mm. Do you feel somehow that you should understand it in a sense?
Yeah, I feel that somebody should understand it. Mm. Not me, maybe. That nobody does seem to quite understand it at least, or find out a solution. I mean... Mm. It is very complex, you know, it's very, very... And when it all flared up and it became really frighteningly dangerous, and we just sort of held back and meandered around things and hoped for the best. And we were lucky enough not to have anybody killed in our family, but my husband's family had people that were murdered, and so many people.
Drawing ballerinas is for your neighbour, and
it was the only sort of when we were in the Abercorn, that restaurant, we were in there the day before, and we could easily, any of us could have been killed in that. But my father went to identify the body because her father was incapable of it. So he went down and identified her body. So that's why I felt a little closeness to her.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So let's turn a bit to your poetry. I want to sort of, there's so many things I want to ask that I won't have time to, but for some reason I was thinking of something Elizabeth Bishop was saying. She was slightly poo-pooing sort of poetry criticism. She was saying, well, basically what you end up with is having to say, well, this person is gifted.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that's how I felt about your work, that you're you know, trying to discuss your poems, only I'm sort of forced to talk about gifts. But she talks about, you know, that any poem has accuracy, spontaneity and mystery, doesn't she, as the three kind of key factors.
Accuracy, spontaneity and mystery.
Yeah, she says that basically any good poet, that's what they've got in them. Yeah. A real accuracy, a real spontaneity and this sense of mystery. And for her, the mystery, you know, is the most important in a way. And I was thinking, if we were to think of your poems, you'd want to turn that mystery to the front.
Well, I think the first poem of Heaney's is accurate, and what was the second word?
Spontaneous.
Accurate, spontaneous, and full of mystery. Yeah, well, I think he touches on the mystery of the child and why this happened. If I would say I was gifted, I would say it took me a long time to become gifted in poetry, because I was desperate to and I was quite ambitious and I was determined, and that all made me a very kind of probably a rather boring companion. So the fun of it, I think what we had from Matthew last night was the sheer fun of the whole adventure. And I have enjoyed it. I have, but it's at the other side, it's at a price of maybe, there's a poem Seamus Heaney has or the wife is complaining and saying, could you not have come down out of your room even for 5 minutes to sit with your family? You know, why are you sitting up there burrowing away at your work? And could you not have given us a little more time? And so I think my family have been very, very patient and understanding of the fact that I don't watch the European football. In fact, I close the door. But I'm interested in it in an extent. But if, you know, you've only got so much life and time, and you have to burrow away at your...
And why do you think you were so intent to write to poems?
Well, that goes back to the Catholic thing, where the nuns, when we were brought up in this cage of whatever it was, and the whole idea was that you couldn't be a priest, but a woman, and I would have done this. We were allowed to, encouraged to go around and clean up after the priests. We could go in. I don't mean, that sounds terrible. I mean, you know, but to go, you were allowed to go onto the altar and collect the towels and the vessels and even the vestments and fold them up and put them away. But you weren't allowed to do what he could do. And I'm not saying that you could do that, but they had this. That was the mystery, was they could turn the bread and wine into... into the body and blood. So that was, I thought, the only thing I can do is write poetry and turn bread and wine into body and blood. I don't know. I think that was part of the kind of... was out of that, I guess, sex change. And I'm still working on that. I'll end up... But we had a wonderful retreat in our local church, and for the first time there was a woman up giving the talks and giving the sermons, and a young, beautiful young girl. I just couldn't believe, and she was giving the talks, but she didn't get doing any of the other.
For you, is poetry a kind of sacrament in that?
Think it is. I think that it's very much a spiritual... I mean, not say that in a kind of holy way, but I just think that it has been sacramental. I mean, I feel that I'm in a very special mental state when I do it, and I'm very... It is like a prayer, you know. Maybe writing the poem, the space of you writing the poem... and you know the idea of the word is the word, and so you know it's very, very privileged to be able to find new words and put them into different combinations and see how they sound and see if they elevate your mind a little bit.
Even in one interview, you were saying that you sort of suspend death for the while when you're writing.
Well, I think you can certainly connect up with the dead. I'm not saying that like there's ghosts appearing or anything, but there can be voices, and there can be, and certainly Tess Gallagher she has so many poems where the dead come and visit her and her father and her mother and people, and she's a book called Dear Ghosts. So And what was it, Matthew saying something about I'm haunting my own poem or something. Yeah, I mean, it's very strange. Very strange. I mean, I'll give you an example of a very strange experience. My father had just died, and I was very, very tragically dealing with that. And I was sitting in a room in my work, and I was reading, as you should not be doing in your work, but I was reading Jared Manley Hopkins' letters. And the letter I read was, "Dear Mother, I know that you don't believe in the Virgin Mary," but she didn't, "but I have prayed that your father would die on one of Our Lady's feast days so that he would go straight into heaven. And I know you would like that." And I was praying, and it turns out that he died on the Feast of the Holy Rosary. So I'm just comforting you and saying, don't worry about him, he's fine. And I looked over the page, and it said, and this was October the 7th, 1870-something, or 1880. And my dad died on October the 7th. And I found that. And that was, I know it's probably just a coincidence or whatever, but I find you get a lot of these coincidences. Indeed, yeah. And they are very, very strange visitations. And they do, I mean, if that didn't mean something to you, what would?
Yes,
you know, it was very, I just thought it was, I felt it was like a direct communication, not only with my father and not only with Jared Manley Hopkins' granddad, but with Jared Manley Hopkins.
Right, cool,
and I was thinking, well, thank you, Jared Manley Hopkins. For and he, as you know, was quite a conflicted character.
I mean, it's interesting, the poems, your poems themselves, they mix the outside and the inside, they mix the past, quite a lot of the poems are found, aren't they? Or at least aspects of them are found.
Oh, yeah, they're all
personal
found.
Personal and impersonal.
Yeah, I mean, they're all found because all the words are found. I mean, you only use ordinary words in ordinary life, but in your poetry you use found words that you would never, really, really amazing words, you know. That you've actually have forgotten the meaning of them. Even like the names of those women in that poem, there's such a splendid poetry in those words, the names of those women. And the names are incredible, especially in poetry, you know. Names of places and people are wonderful words, you know.
Rilke thought we were just here to say names, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, house, door, you know, window.
So, yeah, it's great.
I mean, more recently, we've come to a close, the poems have turned towards war much more.
Well, I tend to do, there's like war and there's love. There's only, you're either a war poet or a love poet. Seemingly, you can't be both at the same time, but this is the way they talk in our country anyway, you know, that Michael O'Neill is the war poet, but he's also a love poet, very much. So one book might be, you know, because when you do a book, they will always want you to make it look like you knew what you were doing when you were writing it, and you actually didn't, but I don't, anyway. I just write these different streams of poems, but then you try to put them together. So I do tend to write one book that's kind of a... It's not political, because I don't really know what that means, but I write stuff that is to do with Irish history, maybe. I mean, there was one time a friend said to me, "Would you write a poem for the 1978 rebellion, because we're celebrating it in 98. And I, again, like shock, what is this? I don't know what you're talking about. I've heard of the 98 rebellion, but how would I write a poem? And So I ended up in the library and was maybe 30, 40. There weren't that many books about the 98, but there began to be some. Mm. And fascinated by it and ended up writing a whole book for her about the 98 Rebellion.
Mm.
Well, not about it, but based on these, you know, that it suddenly heard of all these people that I'd never heard of before.
Mm.
So it was very eye-opening. Mm. It's kind of, yeah, very educational.
I mean, there's lots more to say, but I wanted to just sort of start the close by just sort of asking, you know, poetry has been so important to you. Why do you think it needs to be important for us?
For you? Well, I think just what I was saying about linking up with your bereavements and dealing with your bereavements, I think it's important for everybody because it's... It may not be just the drug that fits everybody, you know. Mm. But for me, it's the drug, and I think as more and more people become more and more literate, and children, and it's the play factor and the all of the things that it gives us, and the reader is the most important person in the whole thing, the reader, you know, because it's this idea, Keats writes a sonnet in 1810, and in 2016, I can read a poem from 1810, and I know exactly what is going on with that person. I know that he's dying, and I know that he's in love, and I know that he's, and the splendor of his words is just such a, I mean, we hopefully will never lose those connections. Mm. So there may not be an afterlife, but I mean, for John Keats, there was nothing but afterlife. I mean, not much life, but big time afterlife.
Mm.
So, you know, you'd like to think that 200 years from now, somebody might be looking you up on their website or something. So you'd like to think that you had. It's terrible, isn't it? You know, do you think that? But really, that was it. I thought, yeah, doesn't matter if you're dead. Sure, people are reading and can see into your mind and through the poem.
In that sense, you're still alive, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're still having an influence on somebody.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a lovely place to think, finish. Thank you very much.
Maybe. Thank you.
So we'll have... a quick cup of tea, and then I'll introduce Maeve's reading for this evening. Immediately by the startling originality of her voice. That's the first thing. You know, when sometimes it's a particular moment, isn't it, for anyone reading poetry, when you discover someone, and you get that, you know, you know, I've never heard anything like this before. This is new in my firmament. I mean, I remember that when I first read Stevens. I remember that, you know, with so many people I've read. And I had it very, very strongly reading Maeve. I've never read her before. She's sort of on my list of people I need to read. Struck by the originality of her voice, it struck me as a bit of kind of carefully orchestrated and controlled extravagance, if you can imagine such a thing. A carefully orchestrated and controlled extravagance. Thought there's even something prophetic about the poem. Part oracle, part erotic, part seer. They seem incredibly personal and private, and yet they're also historical. They blur the distinction between the outside and the inside. They try and wake you up into new ways of seeing the world. It's a very good example for me of these sudden uplifts of the mind that I started with. Again and again, reading Maeve, I had a little uplift of the mind, and I'd just the other night I was reading to someone in my at the retreat centre I'm staying in, saying, here's the start of one, and you know, just read a few lines, yeah, just for that uplift. So I'm really delighted to have. I feel actually personally privileged to meet Maeve, and I'm really pleased that we're going to be able to hear her read. Maeve.
So do we go for war or love or both? Sometimes it's the same thing. Actually, it is the same thing. I'll read one to prove that it is the same thing. Very early poem from one of the first books called The Hollywood Bed. It's dedicated to my daughter who's in a Hollywood bed situation with me at the minute. A Hollywood bed is, you know, in the old films, they weren't allowed to have people in a king-size or a double bed. You know, they had to be in single beds, twin beds preferably. But sometimes they had the two single beds stuck together. But the rule was that one of them or both of them had to have an arm or a leg on the floor during the whole scene. So this was the title of this poem. The Hollywood Bed. We narrow into the house, the room, the bed, where sleep begins its shunting. You adopt your mask, your intellectual cradling of the head, neat as notepaper in your creaseless envelope of clothes, while I lie crosswise, imperial as a favoured only child, calmed by sagas of how we lay like spoons in a drawer till you blew open my tightened bud, my fully buttoned house coat, like some Columbus mastering the saw-toothed waves, the rows of letter M's. Now the headboard is disturbed by your uncomfortable skew, your hands like stubborn adverbs visiting your face or your shoulder in your piquancy of dreams, the outline that, if you were gone, would find me in your place. And this is an early one again. I had different styles depending on whether people thought I was obscure or willfully not wanting to be understood. So some of these poems are willfully not wanting to be understood, but I can explain them, at least I don't think I can explain them. This was one after I had... Was it two children or one children? And I was kind of, you know, told I shouldn't really have any more. I mean, because I'd been not very successful in having the first one. But this is one where I say, I'm going to go on with this, you know, even if it kills everybody else, including me and the baby. So this is, it hasn't got quite the energy of the instructions poem, but so it's just tiny. Lime trees in winter, retouched. Black is my continuum. My black wheat ripens from peach black, vine black, to the resins of darkness. That is how good a picture should be. Oil abetting, light disturbing, hoisted between two windows, like the soul of modesty, constantly straightening against them. But I am agitated less by glass or apertures than moisture trapped like a stain or white secretion, an old swab I was confident had broken down to paste or was ingrained in the next meconium, my intent and cherished waste. I'm not used to this book, sorry. Okay, so, yeah. So those were like two love poems. And here's a war poem, which is also a love poem, sort of. I did visit the prisoners in the jail. And the jail is where Blaris Moore is. Blaris Moore in this book is the townland where the Mays prison was and is situated. So this is a poem about that experience. The Overmother. In the sealed hotel, men are handled as if they were furniture, and passion exhausts itself at the mouth. Play, kisses, stir the circuits of the underloved body to an ever resurrection, a never had tenderness that dies inside me. My cleverly dead and vertical audience, words fly out from your climate of unexpectation in leaky, shallowized night letters. What you has spoken. I keep seeing birds that could be you when you stretch out like a syllable and look to me as if I could give you wings. So, experience of trying to teach them poetry. This is one I wrote for Seamus at some stage. I mean, if we put together all the poems I wrote for Seamus, dead or alive, they would cover the room. So, I mean, because he was one of those people, I don't know, maybe he's not one of those people, but every time you met him, every time he appeared and did anything, you were inspired, and I would just immediately go up, not immediately, but I would record the meeting and record the reading in a poem. So this is one for him, but it's a war poem. The society of the bomb. The sleep of her lover is her sleep. It warms her and brings her out to people, like half making love or the wider, now exceptionally sunlit spring. Before violence was actually offered to us, we followed a trail of words into the daylight, those palest and clearest blues, and all the snow to come. So, yeah. Another, this is an attempt to write something about the horror that we live through and the horror that people here also live through, to be very aware of actually what England and Wales and Scotland also suffered. In fact, were they, you know, the Queen could have been killed, and Maggie Thatcher, I'd not say should have been killed, but could have been killed. Yeah. I mean, they could all have been killed at points. So this one's called At Mullagh Moor, and I'm sure a lot of you will know the reference, Mullagh Moor, off the coast of Galway, and it's where the Mountbatten ship was exploded and the royal family were bereaved. So my prisoners in the jail, and I wouldn't want to read this one to them because they would be saying you're a complete traitor, you know. So that's how complex it was. Is At Mullagh Moor, Earth's memories, in the natural dyes of curtains half fitted to each other. There was a deep today in their different starting points, as if non-being thought it had somehow got the better of being. To love the world of that hour was to hear the weather forecast for a day already lived through, siding with the hurricane, whose presence or absence was the same. The islands hung together through the tasteless water. Though something stayed back and did the telling, every one of us was the one who remained. We were talking earlier about faith and about the church and about all that, and we had sometimes very bizarre things happen, but this poem is called Hand Reliquary, Ave Maria Lane. My saint, there's a whole big problem about me being called Maeve, because she's not a saint. In fact, she's not somebody that I should have been called after. So my second name is Teresa, and my third name is Philomena, who turns out not to have been a saint at all. But there you go. So this is for Saint Teresa. And I do pray to Saint Teresa, and I'm not sure that I pray to Queen Maeve very much, but I invoke her as a tremendous figure. Okay, so anyway, for a while they brought over one of her arms, apparently one of St. Teresa's arms, and it was kind of carried around the country and left in different places. So Hand Reliquary, Ave Maria Lane. God knows that there is no proof that part returns to wholeness simply because miracles happen at a single church going. Her verdant branches labelled with the names of the five senses, the garden not ours, she prayed for her illness to last beyond the grave and be the unsealer of that tree. She might have been dead for a week, though she went on with her deep dying, her womb a transparent crystal turning into a brown relic even before her death. The blinding beauty of her hood opening acted upon me as my own ghost would do, sounding silk, as with a lifting gesture, she tore off flesh from her hand, driving wide her middle finger into the palm of the other, till being a vessel, Christ appeared to her as a dish filled with carved up bread, so unnaturally sweet, so lightly crushed, she could quench the tall language of his image in her mouth, which was the breast wound, always on the point of being taken in his female side. So I've been reading quite a lot of Emily Dickinson recently, and she has these amazing, amazing poems about Christ on the cross and Christ. They are absolutely unbelievable. Yeah. So towards the end of this book, I'd get very involved with my mother. And she was a bit like Seamus Heaney. In that every time I met her, or if any time there was any kind of incident, which there were usually quite a lot of incidents between me and my mother, I'd go home and recover by writing a poem. So this is one of these. Yeah. I mean, so there were actually quite a lot of poems because of that, you know. But whether they're, I don't know. They got me through the thing anyway. It did not get her through the thing. She used to say to me, I like your poem. I like, there's one of your poems I like. I think it's about a badger. Yeah, well, that was thrown out with the... Anyway, it's rather malicious to be compared to a badger. Anyway, the badger. No, this is not. Thorn piece. It's called Thorn piece. Cracked flutes close up by lying in water. Her body far, a paste of dust. A stranger here and there would need shores of oak for the slackest share of perlite or moonlight of sound. With her other face, she is gazing, a woman in communion with herself, her reclining friend, since sleep, the bringer of light, has no plural, and fastens her occasional drunken glance at the touched hand of the snowstorm. Every imaginable heartache that could take place in summer filled the first 20 feet of the spire with a fever of a mild, continuous character, lifting the knot at the breast of March, where her arms form a basin torn up by so many years off the shape of its hinges. Yeah. This is a poem where I imagine my mother in her afterlife, and I just wonder where she is, and because she suffered so much, in this life, and kind of, I don't mean she got to enjoy her suffering, but she kind of was a bit like the Saint Therese woman, completely crazy, I suppose. So anyway, this poem called The Blood Trolley, where I try to follow her somehow into the next world. My mother I did not know at all. Her cameo appearance in the 18 frozen mirrors in her room reminded me of a gold letter on a quartered rose of the same pond, like a heavy mist at a temperature just above the dew point, when its moisture has not yet coalesced into drops of rain. Her heart has moved on, closed an unblemished pearl, beribboning the four spokes or rays of the name Jesus. Beloved document, ash, a residue on the tongue of the mind, punning red ink rose shape, with deep lines on her brows flowing blue. Her body is what has mattered there, registering in its fluency the steady evaporation of the person into her stony likeness, leached away like salts out of a rock. A bittersweet envoy in black stood in all this black, just waiting to be disrobed. The name of the mortuary was Ultimate Sucker. Through the tiniest slits I have contrived to make in the folds of the sari over my eyes, I recognized my mother, selling pickles, sewing padded armbands, walking through the ghetto in a light-coloured coat, wearing thin shoes with straps and with apples and pears displayed in a window, awaiting for a coin. She hid her pot in fear when she saw me. Was she fetching milk? Was there still milk? Where was that rickshaw intending to bring that child with typhoid? Only the better sort of dead had boxes. The corpse bearers wore strange rubber gloves that seemed made of wood. She was still wearing a blouse, a beautiful woman of over 90. I was led by her through those subterranean galleries so many times to her haunting world, where already the angels had started to slam their wings. And now she seems to be driving a vehicle with a large skull in front, or walking a skull on a leash through marshy riches. I have touched death with her white bonework, seen dark things as bright, enchanted by the pleasant shadow of the rich Christ saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace, no function for the heart to serve the dear, the best known face. Let's see. And this is the last poem. No, not the last poem. Not the last poem. It's the last poem in this book, and I'm going to read a few from the other. If you're okay with that, are you okay with that? I think one poem's enough, usually. of me. One poem. The flower of the moment of what comes easily. She sleeps in respect to herself, languorous and numbed by the pure when and where. Her sandal is without power to mark sound. She cannot avoid this haunting, to destroy her surface self by as many resurrections as abandonments, a swan by day and a young woman by night. Her image on the glass window jangles into my room. In the most choked of voices, says nothing to me, a bandage that the flesh has grown over. Even the daylight feels as mute as the fourfold halo of the May moon, or the thoughts we say are ours when stars lose their nests and pearl-like letters are hidden down a mineshaft. A storm draws up that swaying blue sky, its thunder stolen by plumes of explosions in pear shapes like poplars. Thus the unknown rhythm of her looks is softly spilled in the youth of the water, metal-skinned. When someone refuses to meet one's eyes in the long now, across my face stripes the forever tangible gaze of my late mother. Let me see. So I'll just give you a cue from this. Let's see. Yeah. There's with one thing and another, and people, you know, I'm not saying complaining about me being so weird, but I tried quite a lot in some of the poems of this book to be a bit more lucid. Paul Muldoon is the editor of The New Yorker, and Paul Muldoon is a good friend, and Paul Muldoon wrote to me and said, send me a poem for The New Yorker. So I sent him two or three poems that were okay, I thought. And he wrote back and he said, these are splendid, but they're really not what the average New Yorker is looking for in the magazine. So I've been trying to appeal to the average New Yorker and not use any words of more than six letters. There was more to Paul's rejection. It wasn't a rejection. It was you're just too good for the New Yorker, is what he was saying. Anyway, these are a wee bit more lucid, I hope. But they still haven't got in there. Okay, so this is from the reports of, do you know, the Widgery reports and the investigations of Bloody Sunday and what happened in Bloody Sunday, and they're still going on. It's the Savile report, and I think, you know, they haven't really sorted it out. But anyway, this is called The Questioning, so it's a war poem. The Questioning of Soldier L. This month is called A Tender One. It has proved so to me, but not in me. I have not uttered one folly the more for the softness of the season. In cloudy networks we may all be netted together by dark sun affections. Disquietful, we lived and lived, strange moon scenes, I consider the lily's attitude. Bubble blowing caprice with a weather vane on her helmet. Unless I see her life branching into mine, she gives me no ancestral help. Elegant curve of fear and faith, whose arrangements of eggshells had the ghosts of poems in them, knowing to call back, to listen to electric speech when the call is lost. As Mary's veil was said to become luminous during night vigils, I love internal greenness, rusty back ferns, petals backed with pale violet. You're asking a woman of a great many words to recall half a dozen. You expect me to believe you now? I believed you then. Me and my rhetoric should be somewhere inside my head, my own voice, without any connection to my mouth, in the feminized tea shop, in the humming room. I saw nothing in the hands of the man who fell. They saw a rare and previously protected thing, Mr. Whoever Turns Up. And then, you know, again, when there's some significant historical thing like the 1998 rebellion or the 1916, they always tell you to, or they ask you, will you write? So it was the 400th anniversary of the Flight of the Earls, and that was in 2003, I think it was, so it was, or 1604. And this is just a wee poem that goes into that history, and again, it's a war poem. It's all details from historical records. There aren't that many historical records for 1604, but Hugh O'Neill, they all had to leave, or they all left, and Hugh O'Neill was wandering around and he was trying to get into Spain, because they thought if they could get into Spain and they'd bring over an armada and get back home and free the country. But they never got anywhere near Spain. They ended up in France and then in Italy. And this is, there's a letter from Hugh O'Neill to the Pope saying, by the entrails of Christ, would you for God's sake do something? You know, we're here this last 10 years. So it was a tremendous phrase, you know, by the entrails of Christ, you know, because it was like, you know, so this is called By the Entrails of Christ. The O'Neill or Tyrone, born in Dungannon, reared in Dundalk, despite his pale upbringing, addicted to popery, spent most of 1602 on a crannog in South Derry, outside Desert Martin. The ship was a Frenchman and came out of Brittany, sailing from Dunkirk, but letters brought she none from the King of Spain or the Archduke. They should remain beyond seas upon the King's charge, leaving their horses on the shore with none to hold, after the manner of the Tartars, where they best like their pastures. So he carried the sacred vessels of Armagh to the friars of Flanders, being met at the Ponte Milvio by the said archbishop, with 8 coaches and 6 horses to each. They worshipped at the 7 privileged altars, the earl and his gang. They walk even now these streets in black weeds, after the fashion of grandees, rapid marching flambeau of wax lights. So, as you see, I'll just read it. As you see. Yeah, I mean, towards the end of the book, there's a few kind of trying to resolve feelings about the new jurisdiction that we have there, and this is one of them. Black stone mantelpiece with chimney clock. How much Sunday there was in the half-discarded days. Here and there, the flags holding themselves ever more high, stretching as if acclimatized to the born landscape. It had got too late for everything. The lamp yellow mirrors each contain a different emptiness, smooth brown in the eyes, the time of their first brilliance sewn up like the sleeve stumps of an armless man. He makes his saints out of such things, as if woven of fresh reed behind this enduring. wide open silver flowers, hands that know how to sleep, that lie down as if made of a single piece after all that has passed, to rest for centuries, spread open star-like dried flowers, as if in the wells of a paint box. With the lightness of a chime's voice, she gives her consent to the seasons, all their violet hues tucked in, as it were, like certain evenings, to this calm, almost velvet-like air, which is surely not easily introduced. Red orifice facing the front, its inward carmine a little more yielding, will one no longer have to carry its heaviness? It was calling, as it had been calling throughout the weeks, all the time. It needed one in order to feel itself. The things placed upon it add their comments with all their heart, each in its own way. But there is still some other object on the bare mantle, pushed up against the white cloth. This way it is ghostly. It is still the same heaviness, place by place, the windows smaller than they were, reduced and completely in the wrong, in this self-willed old city, holding its own between right and left, hilly, like light music. Finish with this one. It's hard to know what's going on in this one, but it looks nice to me at the minute. Anyway. Yeah. Honey Cross. The clouds set immediately after the sun, that merchant of astonishment, leaving the lower branches scorched. The moon, like the hand of Earth's clock, unlocked an innermost door into a past garden. 15 years ago, on Holy Thursday, they left his corpse on a lonely road. The bloodier newspapers showed the exact spot in his throat. Greyness of heaped paving stones, triangular danger signal, a confessional turned on its side, nicely exposing his heart, red carnations dropped there. I have more than once ducked my head from the sound. It seemed incredible that a woman was hanging linen up to dry where rifles dipped their cranes in salute, like ill-groomed palm trees across the faded vermilion roofs of the thick-set city. Grandmother back from the longer rigmarole of Vespers, Holy Trinity approaching, yet nowhere was there sign of paint on shutters weathered to a silver. The earth was being pulled through some undrawn line of rose-coloured farms and pearl-grey villages to plants in their unhurried flow beneath the land, standing on tiptoe. Christmas flowers that only seem to live in moonlight, bruisewort or common daisy, the warden pear, now our black Worcester, sweet woodruff for Corpus Christi, narcissi, which folk call Laus Tibi, rosemary, husband of lavender, the seven-spotted ladybird, Our Lady's bird, all guarded by Saint Dorothy of the cherries, a German garden saint. Thank you.
So thank you very much, May, for that reading. I really, really recommend the books. May's poetry are one of those poems that we really need to reread. The great test of poetry is whether you can reread it. I was saying the other day that poetry is the only art form written to be reread. And the more, like many of those poems I now know, the more I've reread them, the shock of the language, the strange juxtapositions, the sort of intimacy that is opaque becomes more and more visceral. Yeah. So I really, really recommend that you get them and read them and reread them and get Maeve to sign them. So let's just thank Maeve once again.
Thank you very much for that, and thank you for the technical help and the steward's help and the bookshop, and please go and buy lots of books and have them signed. And there's also the anthology, which has got 200 Ledbury poets in there, accumulated over the last 20 years, so that's a real treat, so feel free to buy that too. And there's a thank you gift.
Oh, you have one. I'm going to give it back. Thank you very much.
And another big round of applause, please, to both of you.